For the second half of the split sermon, we'll hear from our elder, Mr. Wayne Carlson.
Good afternoon. Well, brethren, I often struggle with titles for sermons, but we'll call this one The Main Thing. I think it'll tie in with what Corey was going over, wisdom. We're going to focus upon what the main thing is. The subject is not wisdom, but we'll bring it back around to the feast and some things to keep in mind as we keep the feast. You know, what man calls progress, different definitions upon that, of course, but what man calls progress has given mankind unprecedented affluence. We are blessed beyond what generations before us could even imagine. You know, we have comforts and conveniences that others could not even imagine, the comforts that we have. Yet, as a people, as individuals, with exceptions, as a culture, as a society, we really are not flourishing, though, from the standpoint of healthy attitudes and minds. You know, we have more broken and disturbed families than we've ever had, more children born out of wedlock than has ever happened. Our cars, to show you, you know, how we have this affluence and abundance on one side but don't flourish on another. Think about the new cars that you can purchase nowadays, loaded with so many extras that you couldn't even dream of. You know, you don't even have a key, I think, on some of the new ones, and you just raise your foot or something and the back end opens up. All kinds of entertainment. You can have a screen right there for each passenger. We got remote this, remote that, automatic seat adjust. You know, if you have two or three different drivers, you can program it in, driver one, push that button, automatically the seat adjusts to that particular person. Incredible, those things. Yet, we get in that car, and we're on the road, and we're only one little inconvenience away from going into a rage. We're in this car that has more conveniences than kings used to have in their castles, and we're going down the road, one little thing happens, and boom, we explode. We go into rage. We can travel from coast to coast via airline, and I think a little over 5 hours, I think, if you have a nonstop, I'm not sure, coast to coast, San Francisco, say, to New York, a little over 5 hours, we can go coast to coast, unimaginable. Where when this country was settled, they'd come across with horses and wagons for months on end. We can make that five-hour trip coast to coast, have to be delayed maybe 20 minutes picking up our luggage, and we are fit to be tied, angry as can be, just always a couple minutes away from a rage of some kind. You know, we could go on and on and on with things that people never dreamed of before. Washing machines, clothes dryers, dishwashers, disposal, vacuum cleaners, 60-inch TVs, 100 channels. And yet, we're not flourishing. We don't flourish. We're a sad lot of people overall. You know, there's exceptions, obviously. And with all these conveniences that we have, lines of people seeking an appointment to get in with some kind of a therapist, you know, to get their head straightened out, you know, according to the worldly wisdom, as Mr. Pagliuzzi was going over. So we have this, we live in this world of overextended people, just overextended. The wage earner, he sees himself as overworked, unless you work for the city. That's a different story, but we can't divide this down too closely. You know, the wage earner is overworked. The farmer is overextended. Now, he's got debt coming out of his ears. He's always overextended. The pastors of churches are overburdened because all the families around them are falling apart. You know, look across the world. That's the way it is. Mothers are overwhelmed. There is a mental instability in our time that prevents peace. It prevents peace from implanting itself firmly in our lives. It just has a hard time. We have a hard time finding that peace. I have too much to do, thus I'm not able to rest, thus I have no peace. I have no peace. One man referred to it in a little booklet that Mr. Bagley made me aware of one time. One man referred to it as the tyranny of the urgent. The tyranny of the urgent. We're always, Master Urgent is always behind us with the whip. This is urgent, this is urgent, this is urgent, this has to be done, this has to be done. Well, over and over again, we allow the urgent to crowd out the important. We allow the urgent to crowd out the important. Myself, I am not a big fan of the urgent. I think most of our urgents are created by ourselves because we haven't taken care of the important. You take care of the important, you'll be faced with very few urgencies. I mean, there's going to be exceptions. I can't say that across the board, but ignore the important, and you'll be overwhelmed in time with what we will call the urgent. We have become, again, I'm not speaking to you, I'm just speaking in general, the culture and world that we live in, we become really just a pitiful bundle of miserable, overextended anxiety. We're anxious. We're unable to find that stability of inner peace. It just seems to always be away from us, and we've partly to blame, obviously, we've just completely lost sight of the main thing. Now, we would be wise as God's people to not downplay the role of faith in such things as that. If we will learn through the indwelling of God's Spirit, trusting God, seeking wisdom, as Corey was bringing out, learn to trust God, that inner peace is available. It's there. It can be had. It is achievable, if that's the correct word to use. It is a gift from God, but we cannot downplay the role of faith in that. In Matthew chapter 11, verse 28, no, God didn't call us, brethren, to a hectic life. He didn't call us to be hectic, all frenzy about this and frenzy about that, worried about this, worried about that. That's not what God has called us to do. There's times of heavier loads in your life than others. I realize that. There's times when there's things to get done in a timely manner. But Jesus didn't run around, you know, in a frenzy. He just didn't. Jesus always had the main thing. As one guy said, the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. And Jesus always kept the main thing the main thing. He knew what his purpose was. He never lost sight of that. And you don't read any accounts of Jesus in a frenzy. We read of accounts of Jesus calming his own disciples and apostles when they seemed to be in a frenzy. But Jesus was never in a frenzy. Matthew 11, and we'll pick it up here in verse 28. This is your master. This is your savior. This is how he is. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. He says, I'm not going to give you a frenzied life. I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. Is that not what we want? Is that not what people want? Rest for their souls? That inner peace? That peace that passes all understanding? That's what people crave for that. They want that. They would pay for it. But they won't give up their life for it. In other words, they won't change their life in order to have it and trust God. Because he says in verse 30, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Well, if his yoke is easy and his burden is light, why are we laden down with all these weights? Because we place a lot of weights upon ourselves that God himself never put upon us. Psalms 103. Well, let's turn there. Psalms 103. And verse 13, 103:13, where we read, as a father pities his children, so the Lord pities those who fear him. He's very compassionate, very considerate of us. As a father pities his children, so the Lord pities those who fear him, for he knows our frame. He remembers that we are but dust. He knows what we're made of. We're made of the stuff upon which we walk. We're made of the elements of this earth. And that is not lost upon God. So he doesn't lay layer upon layer upon layer and burden upon burden upon burden upon his people. We need to learn to trust God, to have faith in him, and keep the main thing the main thing. So then we can ask ourselves, well, from whence comes all of these tasks that we see ourselves often saddled with? Where did those tasks come from? How did we come across all those tasks? From whence comes all these tasks? Who gave you all those burdens that you feel like you must carry? Where did all those come from? Have all those assignments you sense upon yourself emanated from God? Or are they emanated from your own imagination or pursuits other than keeping the main thing the main thing? It is not God, brethren, who loads us until we bend or crack. It just isn't. It is not God who loads us until we bend or crack with ulcers, nervous breakdown, heart attack, etc., 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 to no end. You know, such loads that we oftentimes can feel ourselves or sense ourselves carrying, such loads in many cases come from our own inner compulsions, some inner compulsion that we have that this must be done, that must be done. I'm certainly not talking, brethren, in no way about, you know, que sera, sera, whatever shall be, and, you know, and just chill out, don't worry, everything is cool, be lazy, not at all. It's just the burdens that sometimes we believe we carry are burdens we ourselves have placed there, and they are not always of God. Such loads, in many cases, as I said, come from our inner compulsions together with the pressure of circumstances which we tend to label urgent. Again, urgent. We see these circumstances, and they become urgent. James chapter 4, James 4. Let's turn there for a moment. I think we can look at this scripture here in James 4, which we would, I think, most times, and rightly so, and not incorrectly so, look at this to see where wars and fightings come from. Where do they emanate from? Where do they come from? Wars and conflicts between nations, wars and conflicts between people. Well, what about the wars and conflicts within yourself? You know, we have inner conflicts, don't we, at times? Well, think of these scriptures here from that standpoint for a moment or two. James 4, verse 1. Where do wars or battles, you look on your margin as mine shows, where it has wars there, you could actually read battles. Where do some of those battles that you go through, inner battles or with yourself or battles with other people, where do battles, wars and battles and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasures that war in your members? Are not in many cases, not all cases, in some cases, let me back off to that point, in some cases, all of those battles and wars we're in because we're seeking pleasures and stuff, which is not wrong to have a decent life and have pleasures in your life. But if it becomes the main thing, then you've lost track and lost sight of the main thing. Again, the secret is to keep the main thing the main thing. So where do the wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasures that war in your members? You lust and you do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war or battle, yet you do not have because you do not ask. And you ask and you do not receive because you ask amiss that you may spend it on your pleasures. So again, it's a picture of a person or a people not keeping the main thing, and pursuing things that really, in the long run, are just simply not profitable at all. But we feel compelled to continue to push forward. So we find ourselves mentally, as we can physically, we find ourselves with pain. With physical pain, right? You can go through different physical problems that we can develop. And we have pain, and we also have mental pain. There's a condition, there's probably a shorter name for it, but it's called congenital insensitivity to pain. I remember reading a story about this, 30, 40 years ago. It just stuck with me, and I refreshed my memory a little bit about it. But there are children that are born who do not feel pain. They do not feel pain. These children have to be taught that blood is bad because they cut themselves and bleeding, they feel nothing. So they literally have to go, in some places they have these camps that they establish for these children. One of them is called Camp Painless But Hopeful, to go there and teach these children that that's not good. You know, they'll bang their head into something and come up smiling because they don't feel pain. This one gal, Ashlyn, put her hands on a hot muffler, and when she lifted them away, the skin was seared away, and she had no feeling of it. She didn't even feel it. She says, I can feel pressure, but I can't feel pain. I can feel pressure, but I can't feel pain. So they literally have to be taught that that is going to affect them. It's going to cost them their life and cause great damage to them. Well, what is pain? You know, pain, we don't think of it that way, but pain is a blessing. Pain is a blessing because pain brings focus. Pain brings focus. When you feel pain, all of a sudden you focus on whatever that nature of that pain is. You want that pain to stop. Rather it be a little sliver in your finger, a strained knee, or hot liquid, like some of these children that I was referring to who have that insensitivity to pain, they put their hands in hot liquid and they don't feel it. But yet the damage is being done to their body. So when we feel pain, brethren, we react to it. And it's a blessing because it tells us harmful, you know, like Corey with the electric wire. It just takes a little while to learn that. Little side note, I remember, obviously, many decades ago, but we had these electric fences, too. And early on, after Jill and I got married, as young and you could buck yourself up to do some things back then, you can't necessarily feel like you would do at age 70. But, you know, she came from town. She had no concept of electric fences. So, yeah, this is a good target. So, at time, you just buck up and say, I'm just going to hold that wire. And you just grin and bear it and say, come over here, honey. And you put your arm around them. Of course, the one on the end of the chain gets the greater jolt. But that was a long time ago. I could never get the nerve to do that at this point in time. But anyway, but you learn to not touch those fans. And like Corey's saying, we have these new dogs that Joe brought in a couple years ago. And it is digging and destroying everything. So I put a little hot wire around certain parts of the yard. And that hot wire has not been activated for probably a year and a half or 2 years, they will not go anywhere near it because they got shocked by it. They got shocked by it. They learn. But we avoid pain. We want to be rid of pain as soon as possible. And same way with be it emotional or relational pain, we want to be rid of that. Well, sometimes those things come about because we've lost focus. We've lost focus. So even if we're experiencing pain in those areas, we want to focus and say, what am I doing? What's this pain coming from? Maybe I'm doing something wrong. Pain is an indicator that all is not well. Pain can serve a very valuable purpose. As I said, pain brings focus, calm focus into a world of misguided frenzy and a misplaced sense of urgency. Because we get all these things that can begin to come undone in our lives because we're frenzying about here and misplaced with a misplaced sense of urgency. Probably some of those things aren't as urgent as you or I might imagine. Maybe we just need to restructure and take care of those important things and thus avoid a lot of these things which we want to term as being urgent. In many cases or situations, the only thing that is urgent is that we step back from the frenzy. That's what, if you want to say something's urgent, the urgent thing is to step back and evaluate and say, what am I doing? You know, even a drunk, eventually, I've known some that with a few times when they woke up the next day in their own vomit, it gave them enough sense, you know, I probably ought to examine the way I'm living my life. You know, so same thing, you know, the urgent thing to do, brethren, is to step back from the frenzy and say, what do I need to do? Just like a person who touches a hot stove or electric wire, you learn not to go back and do that. Well, we can do that in that part of our life as well. You know, hard work is not that which produces anxiety. Hard work does not produce anxiety. Well, maybe there's some exceptions that don't come immediately to my mind. But then, you know, I'm just one person. It's a big world. But hard work is not that which produces anxiety. Hard work may bring weariness. Hard work will bring weariness to your soul. But that weariness, brethren, you ever notice, is often matched by a sense of achievement. Weary as can be, wore down from hard work. But you look back and there's a certain sense of achievement. I saw it through. I did it. You know, God's that way. Remember when he created, when we read of the creation, what did he do? He looked back and said, that's good. That's good. It worked, but he looked back at step by step through the acts of creation there, and it says God saw that it was good. So it's not the hard work that fills us with anxiety. It's the concepts that we learn that we allow to form in our mind and things that we begin to see as more important, where we allow the main thing to be pushed aside. As again, I'll reiterate as I said earlier, Jesus did not live a feverish life. He just didn't. He didn't live a feverish life. You'll read in the Gospels there several places which I did not note here, but he said he set his face steadfast to go to Jerusalem, because that was the point. It was coming close to the time when he would be taken and crucified, and he set his face steadfast to go there. But again, not this frenziness. It wasn't running here, it wasn't running there. Jesus was not governed by the urgent. He was a man of purpose, not a man of frenzy. The main thing was always at the forefront of Jesus' mind. However, in our case, as human beings, because we crowd our lives with nonsense and oftentimes measure our lives by what we possess, we crowd our lives with really things that are nonsense, and we'll look at some things in Ecclesiastes here in a few minutes that illustrate that. But we crowd ourselves with things that are really not anything more than nonsense, and then we make the mistake of measuring our lives by what we possess. And when we measure our lives that way, we have done lost sight of the main thing. We've lost sight. Jesus said in Luke 12:15, a man's life does not consist of the things he possesses. God is not impressed by that which we own or have the title to or the pink slip to or a deed to this property or that property. In Isaiah 55, let's turn there for a moment or two. Isaiah chapter 55. We'll pick it up in verse 1. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And you who have no money, come, buy, and eat. Yes, come, buy wine and milk, Isaiah 55:1, without money and without price. And he asks a question of those in verse 2. He says, why do you spend money for what is not bread, and your wages for what does not satisfy? Listen diligently to me, and eat what is good, and let your soul delight itself in abundance. Incline your ear and come to me. Hear, and your soul shall live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you. So he said, why do we spend our money on that which doesn't satisfy us? And why do we invest our time seeking those things which are not important? Hear, and you shall live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you. The sure mercies of David. But he says, why do you spend that money? Why do you invest your time and effort in those things which do not satisfy, which don't bring satisfaction? You know, if you could think of a way to try to illustrate this a little bit, brethren, think of it this way, that, you know, we all, as it were, boarded a train. When we were born and our life began, think of this analogy, maybe it'll help. We boarded a train of life at some particular point. At some particular point in time, at some particular station, different times, different stations, but we got on this train. We'll just call this the train of life. We got on that train. We received our instructions from family or culture or education. Somehow or another, we took something in that began to form in our mind, this is the way you live life. Not necessarily good, but we took something in. Either the culture around us or actual education, we receive these instructions that told us this is how you live life. Different instructions, people said things, you know, do this or do that, and you will have a good life. And of course, good life means different things to different people. But we got on that train, we call life, some different instructions for different people. Some people were taught hard work. Some people, maybe they were taught invest wisely. Others were taught seek pleasure. Others were instructed avoid work. Others were instructed obtain power. That's what you want, is power. You want a good life, you need to obtain power. Some were told nothing, probably more so than we care to imagine. Some were told nothing, just wandering souls. You know, maybe play the lottery and you may be lucky. And people just, you know, I've mentioned before, stop at convenience stores and get a cup of coffee. And sometimes when I'm on the road or something like that, just get a cup of coffee and see people come in and go to the counter and drop $5 or $10 on lottery tickets and then go sit in their car and scrape them off. To me, it's just pathetic. I just see that as a very pathetic thing. But they're on that train. That's the train they got on. Well, on the train we were, each and every one of us, you know, chug, 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 chugging along. And you can picture this train going up a winding mountain, you know, where it goes around like this. And literally, in some cases, the caboose, well, I don't even think they have cabooses on trains anymore with the computers and stuff, but the last part of the train is here, and the engine's way up here. The people then can actually see the train, same train they're on, weaving its way up this windy mountain trail. Well, for those whom God has called, we were on that train. We were just chugging along like anybody else, and we were given some insight. We saw that God began to open our minds, and we saw that train winding around, and we saw the front of the train going off in this big cavern. And we saw this sign that said, "Bridge out." And we said, "I don't want to be on that train, because where those lead cars are, this tail car is going to get there." And God gave us an opportunity to get off that train. You're calling. He gave you insight. And you were able to see, you and I were able to see, that this doesn't end well. I went off this train. And we had to reevaluate what we were taught, what was worthwhile, what we should pursue, and we begin to get a picture of the main thing. For those whom God has called, we were given that insight. We knew the bridge was out. The bridge was out. And if the bridge is out, you know what's going to happen. Whatever tries to cross over that is going to fail. Let's go to the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes. And the Ecclesiastes is one of those, which I believe they would call the festival books. Ecclesiastes, I believe in the Jewish culture, and I think if you give it some thought, you can see the wisdom in it. One of the lessons of Ecclesiastes is that wealth and abundance is not the answer. It isn't the answer. It's a good Feast of Tabernacles book because it helps you stay focused. That, sure, we're there and we're able to enjoy things that we normally would not be able to enjoy, finer meals or whatever the case, you know, may be that you particularly like to enjoy. And the book of Solomon here, as Corey mentioned, his wisdom, he invested time in a lot of different things. And I think we go through these, let's look at a few of these, and just keep that term in mind, bridge out. Solomon tried these things, and then after a little while he said, "This is futile. This is futile. This doesn't work." So Ecclesiastes 1, let's pick it up there. Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 12. Look at a couple of verses here. "I, the preacher, was king over all of Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven, this grievous task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and a grasping for wind." What are you saying there? I went for that, I did that, and he's hollering out to you and I, bridge out, don't go that route. It's not going to satisfy you. You're not going to find that peace you want. Chapter 1 and verse 16. "I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness, and I have attained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly." He experienced it. You know, stand-up comedy, everything you can think of, wisdom, folly, he experienced it all. "I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is a grasping for wind." Bridge out is what Solomon is saying. That doesn't pay. Don't bother with that one, because it's not going to give you what you want. Go over to chapter 2. Chapter 2, verse 1 and 2. Here he begins to seek pleasure. Pleasure becomes, maybe Solomon is saying, maybe I can have what I'm longing for in the inside if I just seek pleasure. That's got to be where it is. Everybody likes pleasure and likes to feel well. "I said in my heart," in verse 1, chapter 2, "Come now, I will test you with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure, but surely this also is vanity or futility. Read futility. I think it helps explain it much more. Vanity has a different meaning, I think, in the age in which we live. He said, this also was futility. I said of laughter, it is madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? Bridge out is what he's hollering at us. The bridge on that is out as well. Chapter 2 and verse 4. So he gets involved in great projects, huge projects, projects unimaginable to us, like a businessman building something up great, which is fine, but as long as that's not your main thing. But verse 4, let's pick it up in verse 4. I made my great works. I built myself houses, and I planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants, and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. And I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all of those who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. So even though he went through all of that, he still had his head about him. He's able to evaluate it. Whatever, he says, my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my reward from my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and all the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed he came to the same stinking conclusion. All is futility. All is futility. What do I got? I got myself a big, fat handful of air, is what he's saying. Bridge is out. That bridge was out. That's what God, as we were on that train, again, chugging along, and God gave us the ability through his Spirit and his mercy to say, that don't pay. You know, as they say, that dog don't hunt. Don't go down that one. It isn't worth it. It isn't worth it, is what he's saying. Bridge out. Verse 17, still in chapter 2, verse 17, what is he talking about here? He says, therefore, I hated life. All of these things he could do. But yet, that inner seeking that we have, that inner peace, Solomon says, therefore, I hated life because the work that was done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity or futility, and a grasping for the wind. Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to a man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool. So again, Solomon comes to that same thing. Bridges out. That bridges out. Chapter 5, we'll look at one more I think we got here. Chapter 5 of Ecclesiastes, verse 10. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. He who loves abundance, he will not be satisfied with increase. This is also vanity or futility. So Solomon is saying over and over and over again to us, those bridges are out. Then he points us to some things that are worthwhile and that we do want to hold on to and strive for. We'll pick it up in verse 7. These are things to bear in mind because they are part of the main thing. They are be subtitled underneath the main thing. Chapter 7 and verse 1, he says, a good name is better than precious ointment. What's your reputation? What's my reputation? Do I have a good name before others? Is my name worthy? Under inspiration here, Solomon records that. He says, a good name is better than precious ointment. Another good principle, it is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. So we need to be part underneath that heading, the main thing. We need to be willing to listen to the rebuke or the counsel of the wise, as Mr. Pleginza was mentioning, the wisdom. We want to maintain, we want to have a good name, we want to be able to listen, we want to be willing to listen to the counsel of the wise. And chapter 7 and verse 9, let's go over there, where he tells us, do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. So So we want to check that. We want to make sure that we check anger. Anger rests in the bosom of fools. We want to, through keeping the main thing, that will be conquered, brethren, if it is an issue to any of us. If we keep the main thing, that issue of anger will be conquered, because God's Spirit simply is not going to lead you to be that way. And it will gently remind you that those flare-ups or whatever the case may be are not of Him. And we can bring those into check, bring those in where they should be before God. Chapter 7, again, this is one of our festival books, a good book to be aware of as we go to the feast. Chapter 7 and verse 21 is a good principle to live by every day of our lives, and at the Feast of Tabernacles and every day. Also, he says in verse 21 of chapter 7, do not take to heart everything people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Do not take to heart everything that you hear people say. Who hasn't, among us, who hasn't ran their mouth? James, he says, if a man can control his tongue, he's a perfect man. Well, which one of us hasn't ran his mouth, his or her mouth, and said things that they regretted? Well, he's telling us here, do not take to heart everything people say. Ease up a little bit, you know, ease up. As the saying goes, don't get your knickers in a knot, you know. Don't let your underwear get all bunched up on you emotionally, is what it means. Don't get your knickers in a knot, you know. Take it easy. Take it easy. Don't take everything you hear, don't take it to heart. We've all blabbed. We've all said things that we don't need to say. Behave, brethren, each of us, behave like someone who knows and understands that he has been forgiven. Do you behave and conduct yourself as someone who knows that he or she has been forgiven? Because those who know they have been forgiven, and the greater you know you've been forgiven, the more patient you will be with those who you think have afflicted you in some manner or some way. Because, as the saying is, there but for the grace of God, there go I. So behave, brethren, as someone who knows and understands that he is a forgiven person. Luke 7, we're not going to turn there, around verse 40 covers that. He who has been forgiven much loves much. If you have a tendency to be harsh on others, there's a fair chance you have not yet digested fully what God did for you, that you were forgiven, and that Christ died not for the world, but for you. He did for the world, but it was for you because of your sins. If we have that concept, we tend to be a little bit more patient with human beings. You know, we don't want to be, brethren, as one gentleman I was reading listed this, is don't be a HCP, an HCP. What is an HCP? A high conflict person. A high conflict person. Tends to be in conflicts about this or that or the other thing. Forgiven people, for the most part, don't conduct their lives that way. They just don't. There's a humbleness about them and a patience with others. So we don't want to be a high conflict person. Because most of the time with high conflict people, the issue is not the issue. Their personality is the issue. Their personality is the issue. Because they just land from one problem to another. Keep this in mind, a few other things that we can do to keep the main thing, and in our lives daily, certainly at the Feast of Tabernacles, keep perspective. Keep perspective. Keep first things first in your life. That's the same thing as saying keep the main thing. But keep or seek, whatever the case may be. If you have perspective, keep it. If you don't have perspective, tell God and ask Him for perspective. In other words, it means keep the first things first. Don't, as I heard when I grew up, don't put the cart before the horse. Don't put the cart before the horse. Keep things in the proper order. You know, Matthew 7, 3 through 5, where it tells us, you know, don't go to your brother and say, let me remove that speck from your eye. And the picture that it paints is you're there with this 4x4 hanging out of your eye, been driven through your eye and halfway through your skull. and you want to remove a sliver from somebody else. That's what it's telling us there. You know, we come from different places. Let's go to Matthew 25. I think this is valuable for us to keep in mind. Each day of our life, every day of life, certainly at the Feast of Tabernacles, when we're in close proximity to one another on a daily basis, Matthew 25 and verse 14, this parable of the talents, as it's subheaded in my Bible anyway, 25:14 of Matthew, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling to a far country who called his own servants and delivered his goods to them." So we're told clearly that the kingdom of God is like this. It is a parable, but it is the words of Jesus, and say this ties into the kingdom of God. And he says, "He delivered his goods to them, and to one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1. So he gave 5 talents to one, 2 to another individual, and 1 to another. And then very key what he says, the next few words there, each according to his own ability. We come from different starting points is what it means. We can't look at people and say this about them or that about them. You do not know where they started. You don't know where they started. That's what part of what that parable is telling us. He gave the one 5. He started someplace else. He could handle those 5. But to another one, he gave 2. To another one, 1. We start at different places. We start at different places. So we have to be careful, brethren, and not be looking at others in a standpoint of thinking, well, they should be long past that or long past this. That's, you know, forgiven people, for the most part, brethren, don't behave that way. They just don't. That's just not the way we would behave. So we want to seek or keep perspective, as the case may be. And we also want to seek a sense of proportion, a sense of proportion. It just means you're able to see that some things at certain times have a greater importance than other things, a sense of proportion about things, the ability to understand the relative importance or seriousness of different things and have that in perspective. Matthew chapter 12, Matthew 12, we're in 25, go back a few pages. Matthew chapter 12 and verse 1, good example from Jesus himself about keeping things in perspective. You know, everything in the world is very comfortable to think that everything is either black or white. It's not. The color gray does exist. Gray does exist. There are gray areas that have to be looked at and discerned, being led by the Spirit of God. But there is such a thing as gray. There really is. Matthew chapter 12, and this comes underneath this aspect of asking God for a sense of proportion. Matthew chapter 12 and verse 1. "At that time, Jesus went to the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry and began to pluck heads of grain and eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, 'Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath.' And he said to them, 'Have you not read what David did when he was hungry?'" He's bringing perspective, a sense of proportion. Because what David did, he took the showbread for he and his men. That was against the rules, the law. But by that situation, Jesus is the one illustrating this. Not one of his disciples. Not some modern-day preacher. This is the words of Jesus. "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priest? Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath day, the priest in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless?" How did they profane the Sabbath? They were butchering animals. They were working, physical work. So there are situations, is what we're saying. We have to have a sense of proportion about things and what really matters. In Numbers 11, I'm not going to turn there, it's when God appointed, Moses appointed these 70 men as, I can't remember what title was given to them, I don't think it was elders, but anyway, and they all begin to prophesy, except for there were 2 that had not come to the tabernacle. There were 68 of them came there, and they began to prophesy. There was 2 that were still in the camp, And they were prophesying there, and somebody observed that, and they came and told Joshua, says, Joshua, there's two of these guys that prophesied in the camp. And he went to tell Moses, and Moses, tell them to stop. And Moses says, why are you all exercised about this, Joshua? Why is this a big deal to you? Have a sense of proportion, Joshua. That's what we need to do, brethren. We'll go back and read that if you want, get your mind around that a little bit more. Numbers 11 is where you'll find that. So, brethren, we're saying, you know, we're talking about bridges, you know, bridge out. That's what Solomon is screaming to us. God is screaming to us through Solomon as he takes us through those early chapters. He's screaming to us, bridge out. Don't go that way. Keep the main thing, the main thing. Rigid bridges are not always the best. Rigid bridges tend to break pretty easy. And I know we've talked about this before, but a suspension bridge, such as the Golden Gate Bridge, it links those two pieces of land, that two pieces of real estate, together. And that bridge is not rigid. It's suspended by cables. I couldn't find them. I got someplace the information on. But I know that that bridge, which has been there for decades upon decades now, that bridge can move 16 feet up and down. 16 feet. And I can't remember the sway. It can sway, I want to think, 10, 12 feet, if not more. It's not rigid. But what's it done for all those decades? It's connected these two pieces of land together. Right? It's flexible. It's flexible. Now, this is not nothing, hey, chill out, take it easy, the law of God doesn't matter. That's not what we're saying. It's just have a sense of proportion. Have a sense of perspective about things. Don't be a rigid bridge. Rigid bridges break. Rigid bridges come down. Ecclesiastes 12, let's turn there, it'll be our final scripture. Ecclesiastes 12. Many of you know exactly what we'll read here. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. The conclusion of the whole matter, it takes us all through the book of Ecclesiastes, where God, through Solomon, has said, bridge out, bridge out, bridge out, don't go that way. And he concludes in chapter 12 and verse 13. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether it is good or whether it is evil. So what is that verse telling us, brethren? I think it's telling us, always keep the main thing, the main thing.